Hey, this is Jonathan Goodman, and I have incredibly exciting news. My book, The Obvious Choice, is now available for purchase in Kindle, in Audible, and in hardcover. Anywhere that you find books, please go on Amazon, please go to whatever bookstore you like, buy yourself a copy, buy a copy for a friend. Hope that you absolutely love it. Now let's get into the show. I mean, I told you straight up, like, I don't expect any of the work that I'm doing for platform growth and with the books to really start to begin to gain any kind of groundswell until the next book comes out, Obvious Challenge, in spring of 2026. Obvious Choice was started 3 years ago, for context. So that's what, 4 or 5 years in? Well, welcome back to the Obvious Choice podcast. This is our first episode recording actually after the book has come out. So we're going to give a bit of a recap on how things are going. I actually still don't have numbers. Which is part of like what I'm going to record on. It's fucking weird, man. The whole thing is a black box. Like the whole thing is a black box. I haven't heard from anybody. Like the only reason that I had any indication that my publisher was happy at all was because I asked them a question about something else. And then for like the next book. And then as an aside, my editor got back. And he said that the rankings are looking really good. Like that is the only interaction I've had with anybody from the, it's the weirdest thing. So I have no idea how many copies the books have sold or anything like that. I should find that out. I don't know, end of this week, maybe. But we'll give you a recap on like what's happened, what hasn't happened, what's gone well, what hasn't gone well. We'll give a recap on that. But yeah, there's a story that I've never told, and I realize that I've never told the story before, and I think it's worth telling because I was remembering it, and I'll tell you why I was remembering it. It has to do with short-term versus long-term kind of kind of goals and rewards and how you manage those two right against one another. Right. And so way back in the day for Ignite the Fire, my first book, this would have been like 2009 probably circa that this would have happened, maybe 2010. I had produced the first, it would have been like the first draft of the book. It was really, really messy. This is before I had gotten an editor even. So it was like, it was really, really messy, but I had decided that I was going to do this as a book, right? And so I started reaching out to people, and I tell the story in The Obvious Choice about how I went to the bookstore and found best-selling fitness books and cold emailed the authors of them and got in touch with their editors and ended up hiring one of their editors, right? Well, the part of that story that I didn't tell is I also got in touch with other people figuring out what to do with this thing. And one of the people that I got in touch with was in like, call it an internet marketer. So at that point, I was reading fitness blogs and things like that. And I'd come across all of these lists of like the top online fitness entrepreneurs and whatever. And this is like the internet ebook heyday. So for those of you who were not around at this time, kind of around like 2010 for a number of years, these ebooks were selling for like $67 to $99 each. And it was ebooks about everything, but professional development ebooks, it was ebooks about fitness, workouts, whatever. And the reason that they were selling for $67 or $99 and then there was upsell on upsell on upsells because there were commission structures, and the commission structures for people who promoted them would often be upwards of 75 to 100%. So you put out an ebook for, call it $67, you actually give the person promoting the ebook for you 100% of that $67. But then you, of course, have upsells on the back end of it. And then you get 100% of the upsells, right? And there were different structures like that. Anyway, I got in touch with one of the guys who was promoting this thing, and he tried to convince me to turn Ignite the Fire into an ebook like this. And I can't remember exactly what it was. It wasn't an ungodly amount of money, but I think to me at that time it seemed like an ungodly amount of money. I think he wanted $10,000 to basically like build this into an internet product. And so he was going to, you know, take the book, put it on ClickBank. ClickBank is the service. It might still exist. I don't know. Is the service the kind of the marketplace? He had his network of affiliates that were going to send it out. All of these promises, right? Whether we would have delivered them on them or not, I'm not actually sure. And I seriously considered it. And, you know, the end of the story, obviously, I did not go in that direction. I went the direction of putting it into a physical book and selling it as a physical book. And I don't actually remember why I decided to do what I did. I don't remember why I decided to do it as a paperback book and not as a, call it an online product. But I was thinking back to that the other day when, and here's the thing. I think I probably would have made way more money short term.
Yeah.
If I made it an ebook. I really do. I think Ignite the Fire in 2010 and 2011 would have made me much more money than Ignite the Fire made me in 2010 and 2011 as a physical book. If I did it as an online product. I would be very curious to go back and split, you know, go in that direction in the time split and mm-hmm. see where my life would have taken me if I made that choice. Because I think about all of the things long-term that Ignite has done for me. And I don't think they would have existed. I mean, if that was an online products like those ebooks, I mean, you know, like, they did not last more than 3 months, 4 months, for the most part. They did their thing. They sold. Some of them, you know, have sold for a couple years, but most of them didn't. But they certainly didn't get passed along. They certainly didn't build the reputation of the person. There are some examples like Eat, Stop, Eat, you know, by Brad Pilon, but really, like, he was the first person to popularize intermittent fasting. So, mm-hmm. You know, that's perhaps an outlier case. How would my life have been different, do you think, if I had taken the more short-term approach and decided that I wanted to make more money but built something that was perhaps less serious?
It's an interesting question because for the listeners that weren't really maybe around then, or just, you know, just not aware, because there's a point in time up to which people just kind of didn't know that there was a such thing as online marketing of any kind. Like, it didn't really catch on. I could say conservatively that maybe Vaynerchuk was one of the people that sort of mass yelled at the, you know, at the universe to tell everybody that there was even such a thing. But that was a definite flavor of the month back then. And what I'm wondering is, I'm more curious about your development as a human and author than what the profitability long term might have been. Because I'm just sort of wondering, John, like, do at this point in your life, being the January cover model for Midlife Mail, at this point in your life, would you have even had the skill to take advantage of the opportunity to write Obvious if it hadn't been for some of the things that just naturally have to occur when you're building and publishing an actual printed book? It seems like maybe you would have been behind, your skill would have been behind the series of opportunities that actually publishing Ignite the Fire prepared you for. Like the timetables and things might have been off.
Obvious Choice in so many ways has been the Obvious Choice in so many ways is the culmination of so many things that I've done over the years. I read through the book again because I got the Kindle. So I read through the book and I highlighted it as, you know, as a Kindle so that I'd have those notes in my Kindle thing mm-hmm. over the last week or so. And I was reading through it, but it's interesting reading through it in a different medium because I can consume mm-hmm. it a different way. I've never read it electronically like that before. And I'm just going through all of these experiences in my life that, like, behind the scenes in the back of my mind that, like, led to, oh, this is when I had that point of awareness. Oh, this was the project that I did at that point that led to this thing. There's no way. And I think that's what makes good books really good books, right? Is that you can't, man, I look at some of those other books, like, yeah, for example, the Wealthy Fit Pros Guides books. Anybody can write those books. They're not bad books. They're good books. They're very useful books. But they are books that anybody can write by researching them. And spoiler alert, those were ghostwritten. They're my work for sure, but they're ghostwritten. And so the ghostwriter, of course, did a lot of his own research in putting those together. Whereas Obvious Choice and then Challenge, the next one that's coming out, man, like you can't not have had a lot of the experiences. So I think, yes, but it's not just the writing of Ignite the Fire that led to Choice, right? It's all of the other business ventures. It's how many different ways I've tried to say things and sell things and build platforms online. I mean, you've been privy to enough of them.
Enough. It's like you're climbing a ladder, and I think the absence of that experience removes like two or three rungs from the ladder.
Yeah.
So could you have made it to the next level? Yeah, but you got some rungs missing. Maybe you got to jump and hope that your grip strength is enough. The comedian Louis C.K. I'm sorry, I was going to call him Louis C.K. I saw a quote from him that said, "If I went back and corrected all the mistakes that I made, I'd erase myself." which was a great quote. I mean, it makes sense. Yeah. That's sort of how I feel about it. I think I'm gonna play conspirator here, John. I think if Ignite is an ebook, it totally changes the trajectory of your life. I think there's a whole different other version of John Goodman. We never get to this one.
I really do. I think it forced me to figure out a lot of things.
Yeah.
That were like not easy at that time to figure out. How do you make a book, right, in 2010? It's not as easy as it is today. You had to put together this random smattering of contractors. I mean, even today, it's not easy to make a book. It's easier, but it's not easy to make a book. But also, there's an element of seriousness, I think, towards certain projects and not towards other projects. And that's not necessarily even, I think, legitimate. Like, there are ebooks that are exceptionally well put together. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Most of them aren't, though.
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of digital projects are simply not that seriously taken on. Not to say all of them aren't. Of course some of them are. But there's something about tangibly holding something and passing that on and seeing that somebody has something that they've clearly put a lot of work and effort into and finalized that thing.
Yeah.
I think a lot of my career that's followed then has kind of been in the tailwind of Ignite, both because this is how I decided, you know, that to me was a statement to myself of how I wanted to show up in the world. And it's also been my most popular book still.
Right.
So maybe I'll match it one day. But I think there's no question that Choice is a better book, whether it will over time outsell Ignite or not. I'm not sure, but I hope that it does. But
just
also,
go ahead. I was just going to say, you also had a really great intersection of the information in Ignite and where the industry was at the moment, because kind of nobody was giving practical, actual instruction about being, I don't want to use the word successful, but for lack of a better term, about being successful as a personal trainer. Like the fact that you took notes from actual experiences and then sort of wrote a manual of sorts.
The whole industry back then was so academic.
It really was. You couldn't, it probably, probably a reason why I did not enter the industry until 4 years after that, because that's when I started to encounter sort of instructional business. Here's what it's actually like to stand up for 6 hours and walk around and talk to people right. randomly in the gym.
You should bring with you multiple pairs of socks.
Right. Right. Before that, it was all, this is the insertion point of the muscle, and here's the origin point, and here's how you activate it for your client. Most of what was in the industry then. So I think as your dad often says about striking when that iron's hot, I think it was just a really appropriate time for practical application from a guy who says something like, I could have moved further away from where I worked for cheaper, but I paid a little extra and I was closer to the gym and my mood was better as a coach and I could get there fat. Like, nobody was talking about that shit back then, man.
Yeah.
So I mean, it was not really
many people are talking about it.
Even now.
You know, that's, I agree with you. I think that one of the reasons why the book hit was because it hit into this kind of bubbling underneath the surface, like cultural zeitgeist. Like a lot of people, I was not the first person to think these things. I think I was just the first person to say them publicly in a way like that. I think choices like that too. Yeah. I mean, I'm certainly not the first person to think, oh, actually, guys, most of what we're doing on social media is really fucking stupid.
Right.
You know, hey, has anybody else ever thought that maybe I'm wasting my time here? You know, like I'm clearly not the first person to say that. But there's absolutely this frustration that is bubbling, not just underneath the surface, but bubbling over now. And choice is really tapping into that. Like, absolutely. There is a much more simpler way. And it's, you know, already I'm getting messages from people that are passing along the work. Like I got one this morning from a reader, and she said, you know, my wife works in real estate, and I mentioned to her the example that she used in the book about the nosy neighbor open house, and she immediately told a group of probably 10 agents this morning about it. She said, what was most impressive so far to me about the book, and what I'm finding that I've been incredibly guilty of, is missing what's right in front of you. Mm-hmm. I always try to look at these things I'm learning as things I can teach my daughter, and there are some great lessons here. It's funny how when you keep things simple, it almost always works out better. I think a lot of people have, you know, they know that secretly. It's like the example that I give of the trainer in the gym with 20,000 members, where nobody was on the gym floor, or two people were on the gym floor when I did a tour of the gym with management before I was, you know, doing the meeting to help them with their sales, and then they all materialized in the room. It was like a group exercise classroom that we had our meeting in. They all materialized in that room for a meeting, and I asked them where they were, and they were all in a break room. Basically working on their content, doom scrolling, social media, whatever. And Jenny, you know, put up her hand and said,
"Poor Jenny.
What can I do on Instagram to get more clients?" And she showed me her phone, and she had, you know, 5,000 plus followers, 3,000 plus posts. And it was a beautiful Instagram. It was a really well done Instagram account. And I can't even imagine how many hours, hundreds of hours, maybe even thousands of hours she spent on it. And I just remember asking her, I was like, have you ever gotten a client from Instagram? She says, no. And I just didn't say anything else. And then she said, okay, so what type of content can I post? And I just said, what do you think is more valuable to you? 5,000 people on Instagram somewhere in the world who have kind of heard about you, who like a post that you made about what you ate this morning for breakfast, or 15 wealthy and well-connected people in this building right now at this very second. And the air just left the room. You know, you can kind of feel that sometimes. It was like 30, 35 people in the room. There was 20 trainers, but it was all their sales staff and stuff too. So it was like 30, 35 people in the room. And you just kind of feel the air get sucked out of the room, and you just look around, just like every single person so clearly knew what they should have been doing all along.
Right.
But we're fighting it. And I get why they're fighting it. I get why it's harder to go up to a real person and speak to them. What do I say? What do I do? And so that's, you know, that's what we spoke about. We talked about how to do that on the gym floor. We talked about how they're basically, from when somebody first joins the gym, how they can do mm-hmm. a much better job in inviting this person and putting them into their initial, I forgot what they called them, but you know, their sales staff, but they give it some nice name, their initial kind of consults and stuff. And, you know, cause their entire initial consult was at this gym at that time, I don't know whether it still is, was basically around telling somebody that they need personal training. And right. So it was, you know, measuring them every which way and then creating goals for them and then selling them on like 6-month training packages. And,
yeah.
And I was like, what's your conversion rate to this? Like, oh, about 3%. Okay. So you're converting 3% of new members coming into your gym that are already joining your gym with a membership to personal training. Do you think that's a good conversion rate? And then how many of these people are then going up and signing up for training afterwards? And they didn't even know that number. It's like, clearly here, there's a different approach that needs to be made where you need to make them feel, you know, much more comfortable and like they're part of the community. And,
it's so awkwardly obvious. You've got 100 people that come into your restaurant and say, I'm famished. And three of those people buy a hamburger. Like something's gone wrong in the restaurant. Like literally people coming to a place where you can only do one thing. The only thing you do at a restaurant is eat something. And three out of 100 get something to eat. You've made some error at the door, sir.
It's funny. I never thought about it that way.
It's only, crazy though, right?
One thing you can do when you walk in here.
One fucking thing you do in the gym.
We all know what you want to get out of this.
As soon as you came in. There's only one
thing you can do. And yet 3% of you are deciding to do it.
3 out of 100 will do a push-up. I mean, or...
Yeah.
So my favorite thing about Obvious Choice is it makes it okay to know not to do something that most people do. Here's what I mean by that.
Yeah, tell me more.
Almost every book in this space, let's just say that the audience was specifically online trainers. It's not. It's a book for every. It's a book for life, actually. But let's say it was specifically for online
trainers. It's a business book. It's a life design book disguised as a business book.
As a business book. And in my review, that's sort of what I indicated. Like, hey, be careful. You think you're about to read a business book and you're going to get a bunch of life lessons. So watch yourself. It's sneaky that way. But let's say it was just for that. It would be the only book in that category that would say it's okay to use social media. Also, it's not okay to use social media. There are two different games happening and you will want to play the game that doesn't score you any points. I'm going to show you how to pick the correct game. It's basically what it's saying to me, because most books say you have to have this following on social media. You have to build that following this way. You have to nurture your following. It's a social media economy. You're going to become an influencer. But this one says, hey, you can be a coach on social media who uses it to build your coaching business, or fair enough. You want to be an influencer. Bro, you can do that. But most of you who want to be influencers are mad because you're not getting clients. And most of you who want to get clients are mad because no businesses are asking you to put their shirt on your back and advertise it because you're playing in the opposite direction. Everyone's going the wrong way on the train tracks, hoping not to get run over. Here's how to figure out which way your train should go. make that obvious choice by reading the book. And that's why when we first had a conversation about this on the last podcast that aired, I was like, man, I think this thing folds in and folds in and folds in. And it's probably a year or so away from the big understanding of exactly what it is, because it's what people don't know that they need yet. Like It's what they don't understand about themselves yet. They don't know yet that they don't know how to choose the right game. So they just all play one game.
You kind of need to get a whole bunch of followers to realize how useless it is.
How useless
having a whole bunch of followers is. You know, it's so funny though. I wouldn't even say that. It's not useless at all. There's a difference between being an influencer and a thought leader, right? Like an influencer is somebody who entertains around a subject and has a lot of followers. But like, you don't look at that person and you're like, oh, they've done really great things. And so I'm going to follow them and I admire them. There's somebody who just has figured out a way to make really, really good superficial content on social media that gets attention.
Which is a skill.
Which is absolutely cool. A skill. That skill
ain't gonna get you no clients.
It ain't gonna get you very many clients. That skill is a very useful skill if you are teaching other people that skill.
Yes.
Right now, but it's fascinating because I have a lot of friends who have big followings, right? And almost across the board, they're like the biggest champions of this book because a number of them have even said to me, they're just like, I knew I was doing the wrong. Like I have a million followers on TikTok. I can't sell 25 goddamn t-shirts.
Right.
One guy literally just told me that. Like, you know, these are people with half a million between Twitter and Instagram, for example, you know, 800,000 to 900,000 followers. There's three different guys like that I know. All three of them are just like, it's so... the fact that I spent so many years obsessing over, you know, social media growth, like I don't regret it. The assets now, that's a distribution channel. You get your messages answered for sure.
Right. Right.
Here's something really stupid that's been happening. So I don't have as many followers on Twitter, for example, on X. But I spend a fair bit of time there. I like the community there for the most part. So I spend a fair bit of time there. And what's interesting is that a number of the people who I sent VIP copies of the book to, even if they are much more active on X and like not active at all on Instagram, they did not share the book on X. They shared the book on Instagram and tagged me because I look more important on Instagram.
Right.
And so them sharing the book is not because they want to support me. It's because they want to improve their own social status by saying, look, this important guy sent me a copy of the book. Well, that would not have happened on Twitter because I don't look as important on Twitter.
Right.
And so they didn't share the book on Twitter. Isn't that interesting?
That's
it's so much stuff about the social media, like circle jerk kind of high school cafeteria little world. It's so unbelievably frustrating in the short term and so completely comically irrelevant in the long term. That, you know, I kind of just like fight not getting upset about it because I know just how irrelevant it is. But I'm just like, guys, like really? Like really? Like you clearly spend more time and effort here. You're never on that other place. You're so obsessed with your own world and what you see and how important you feel like something makes you look. That it dictates your actions to this extent. It's like, man, that's wild.
We are. As professionals, we are more than ever before in the perception era of business, right? Mm. I feel like 80s, 90s, maybe even early 2000s, we were in the production era of business. You know, all the old books that I read and CDs and tapes, that's right, listener, I said CDs and cassette tapes that I used to listen to were about people who produced whether it be those Nightingale Conant.
If you've listened this far into the podcast, I want to invite you to buy a copy of my new book, The Obvious Choice. It's available now. A lot of people have been asking me what the book's about. The central premise is that it's learning how to position yourself as the clear and trusted answer to a specific group's problems. You see, a lot of people these days are trying to become famous to the faceless, anonymous internet, instead of becoming the obvious choice to a smaller amount of people who are going to buy from you. It's actually much better, much more profitable, much easier, and much faster, and much less stressful to be obviously perfect to a smaller amount of people than just okay to a lot of people who are never going to buy you. You see, you don't need to be the best at everything or chase the largest audience. You need to become the most relevant to your people. What I do is I emphasize the importance of understanding your audience's needs, meeting them where they already are, and delivering such value that choosing anyone else feels irrational. And so pick up a copy of the book. It's in Kindle, it's in Audible, it's in hardcover, wherever you find books. Hope that you absolutely love it.
Cassette tapes and CDs, Think and Grow Rich, and win, you know, How to Win Friends and Influence People. All those things were sourced from people who had produced something in real world context and had success. And that's who you were learning from. And then it quickly switched. No disrespect to Tony Robbins, because I know he's a dynamic speaker. He built his empire, but he's kind of dynamically speaking about being a dynamic speaker a lot of the times, right? There's you know, I, as a layperson, I can't point to anything in the real business world. It's not like he invented iPhone or something like that, right? And then you get into the Vaynerchuks who've had some success in business, but a lot of what we see now in business learning is based on how we perceive the entrepreneur and their assumed influence more so than what they maybe did practically, which is cool. But because of that, things like what you just mentioned happen. And we would get coaches in the Online Trainer Academy and Online Trainer Mentorship who would say things to us like, I'm having trouble getting clients. Where are you sourcing clients from? Mostly through my social media. And then you go to their page and it's like 30, 40, 50,000, 100,000 followers. And you're like, you can't get five clients out of this, right? And that becomes something that's, again, so obvious to us from the coaching side, but something that they really just don't even notice. Like you.
But they're also afraid to use it.
They are afraid.
And I used to talk to somebody. Afraid to use it, because when you use your social media to generate business, you will get less engagement on your social media.
Oh, absolutely.
And so how does that make you look to others, right? I mean, who cares? It's the answer.
Right.
They're afraid to use it because
it's a dead zone.
Because they're not going to get the views that they're used to. And
100%.
That's become such an important part of their day is seeing the engagement for things that get these big pages. But I mean, this conversation comes down to like, and the idea of the story that I started with Ignite the Fire, where, you know, there was the decision between making it an ebook versus a physical book, and how the ebook probably would have made more short term. I think the reason why I started thinking about that was, you know, I've got the Online Trainer Mentorship, and then I've got these books that I'm working on. And there's other things, of course, too. There's Quick Coach, there's other stuff that I have as well. But they seem to be in conflict sometimes. You know, that my career, my authorship career, which is really my next stage personally, is authorship. Is very much dependent on me building a thought leadership platform, email list, social accounts. Like, I'm playing that game, very much so. That's just what the game that I decided to play. And I know it's a very, very long-term game. Mm-hmm. I mean, I told you straight up, like, I don't expect any of the work that I'm doing for platform growth and with the books to really start to begin to gain any kind of groundswell until the next book comes out, Obvious Challenge, in spring of 2026. Obvious Choice was started 3 years ago, for context. So that's what, 4 or 5 years in? But OTM, the online trainer mentorship, makes a lot of money. And if I put all of my efforts into the online trainer mentorship, we would make more money with that program. There's no question. If all of my content was around business for online trainers, scaling business for online trainers, you know, writing books about how to scale online fitness businesses. I mean, we could write the best book in the world, unquestionably, of how to scale coaching business. I've already pitched my agent about it. We still might do it. Like, we might do a traditionally published book on it at some point. But I think about, you know, like, if I did that, though, short term, it would feed the online trainer mentorship. Long term, though, I don't think the online trainer mentorship would exist. Mm-hmm. And so it's this weird kind of disconnect, because the books and all of the other stuff that I do almost feeds like a brand and a reputation that becomes known as something that's different and unique and higher quality, perhaps more thoughtful than all of the other folks that you see out there that are shouting very, very loudly all over all of their platforms every single day about the topic of the online trainer mentorship, where you have the recognizable face in front of it, right? Who would be me for the mentorship. You have, you know, for whatever those businesses are. You have that person, that man, that woman doing those things. But they're constantly reinventing themselves over and over and over again. Different programs, different offerings, different. Whereas we've been able to build just this beautifully eloquent, high-quality program that's super stable over a lot of years. And we'll be doing it in 10 years, right? Whereas I don't think any of these other folks will. And so it's the same kind of conversation, I think, is why I thought about it, Ren, is like, you know, the it's so hard because you need the short-term stuff in order to obviously feed yourself and grow your business. But the long-term project, I think, is so valuable to have because it's the work that others don't do. Even if it pulls away from the short-term stuff, even if this long-term project is not the one that's going to hit, maybe it'll be the next, maybe it'll be the next. The other part of it, though, here's the other part. Let me know what you think about this, Ryan. Sometimes you got to just have something to do. Like, you know what the best, you know what the best thing that I ever did was? When I finished The Obvious Choice, was I started the next book.
Right.
It's the best, thing I did. I would have gone, this last couple months, particularly this last month, you know how buckshit crazy I would have went? If I didn't have the next book?
You'd have been obsessed with every message, review, number, communication. I have no investment in the Obvious Choice book, and yet I still find myself scampering to see if there's another. Is there another review? Was there another review yet? Yeah, it's just
Amazon's been squashing him. I don't know why.
I'm consumed by your consumption of the subject. I think it's always like that when you've been adjacent to a process for a long enough period of time. It's a great lesson for our students across the PTDC instructional places, because it's for me and Amber, I can't speak for Amber, but I will assume as she installs trap doors in her kitchen.
Whatever she's
doing. Yeah, that's probably what she's doing. I would assume that because we were so closely involved in so many of your conversations, yeah. we just got to be close enough to watch and hear. We were close enough to hear the whispers, is how I put it. But for us, it was very much like permission marketing. And we've had that conversation on the podcast before, so that we feel invested in it, right? And it's a great lesson for our students out there that it's okay to pull people in close and kind of chat with them a little bit about what you're building for them or around them, because there's a natural, consistent, gradual attachment to the thing as the closest outside person, right? And then when it's presented, you have sort of a vested ownership in it. It's almost involuntary. I just kind of just want to know what's happening because, and like I said, you know, I was hooked from the first header on the first page. Business was great once because I remember two and a half years ago.
I know.
You saying that, I got this great line from this book. And, you know, I love the way this starts. And you said, I can't remember what the actual line from the actual book was.
Elantris was great once. Elantris was beautiful once.
Okay. So just knowing that as I read it, I had much more interest in every paragraph in the book than I would normally have in a book. And I think it's such a great example for me of what the power of sort of a permission-based marketing could be, letting people in a little bit to let them know, here's where I'm going with this. You know, here's a poll. If you had to have a coach talk about this, this, or that, which one would be more important to you and why? And then someone actually enrolling in my process or seeing that it's debuted and saying, oh, he actually used that thing.
Yeah.
Let me dive in more to this. It's such a great asset. And I think that's why I'm so attached to what's been continuing to happen.
We'll get back. I mean, the whole first draft of the next book is done, and we haven't gone over a lot of it yet on the pod. So we'll get back to doing that for the next one. But I don't know what questions do you have. You said you wanted to ask about the outcome of.
I had a few questions.
It's not the outcome yet. It's a week.
Right now, I know
it's been a week since the book has come out. You know, so what outcome?
And I know that. I was initially questioning numbers and stuff like that, but more so now after having this discussion, like, do you feel as if what often happens is someone will do something in the context of fitness. I've had clients lose hundreds of pounds and just not see that at all, right? Because of the way that the mind works. They would say things to me like, when I look in the mirror, I see the same body. I'm like, you lost 100 pounds, bro. Like, it's not the same. Like, have you come to an awareness, an acceptance that this book now exists and people are reading it and consuming it? Or does it feel as if I still need to promote, and promotion never stops, but does it feel like I still need to promote this in a way that frantically introduces more people? Or can I let the readers that have it consume it? Like, are you free to allow the reader to consume yet? Or do you still feel like you're in that place where I kind of want to turn the pages for them and narrate it to them and explain to them what I meant by this thing? Like, can you accept the finalized project yet? Or is that still weeks or months or years away for you?
I can accept the finalized project. Yeah. I'm very, very happy with the finalized project. Can I accept that it's released? I've always been very siloed, even just physically. I mean, I live in a small town in Mexico right now.
Right.
I mean, I'm not around people often other than my family and some friends that we have here, but friends that we have here generally come and go every few weeks. So no, I haven't accepted that yet. I don't know if I will. Does it feel like it's real that it's out yet? I don't even know what that means.
Right.
D- Do I feel like the book has been successful upon launch? I don't even know what that means. I have no idea what... I mean, I know how many books I need to sell, give or take, in order to earn back my advance. I obviously haven't come close to that yet. I won't come close to that for a long time. I think that I will. Is my publisher happy? Are the people who worked on the book happy with the initial sales? I have no goddamn clue. I really don't. I mean, I don't know. Perhaps it's something that I'll do better next time is I'll speak to them and I'll say, hey, what's a win for you? You know, right. Can we make this a little bit more tangible so that I know what I'm shooting for? But it doesn't seem like they care that much, I think, because they understand the reality of the situation. They right. knew when they signed me as an author that this was not going to be a book that was going to go super, super viral at launch. Mm-hmm. They knew that, right? They knew that. They knew that while I had an audience and a platform, it's not the type of audience and platform that's going to sell 15, 20, 30,000 books at launch. Mm-hmm. There are not that many people who can do that. And particularly this is the first book. So they knew that it was always going to be a long-term thing and a slower burn, right? The initial rankings for the book were very, very good. For almost the entire first week, the book sat somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 of all books on Amazon. That's really good. For a business book, for a guy who does not have an audience really in the business world, mm-hmm. that's really good. There is still yet to be anything other than a 5-star review. There's 120 some reviews between Amazon Canada and the US, and every single one is 5-star. I don't think I've ever seen that before. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure that there will be a review that is not 5 stars at some point.
Oh, absolutely.
But initial response to the book has been outrageously positive. Like people are surprised. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you expect? Like, a business book comes out, a marketing book comes out. Everybody always has a hook with a book, right? Mm-hmm. Most nonfiction books, to be honest, are just kind of shit. Like, even if the ideas are good, like the books are just not that interesting to read.
Right.
There's only really one or two kind of big ideas. And so once you get that, you just kind of start nodding your head after for a while, and then you just put the book down. I think, you know, the initial response that I'm really happy about is how much people are already talking about how much they enjoyed the book, how pleasantly surprised they were, how useful yeah. they found it. Stories like the one that I told today where, you know, other industries from ours, it's always going to start from my industry, right? It's always going to start. So, right. you know, this person who texted me, Cassandra, is in the fitness industry, but her partner is in the real estate industry. That's how this stuff kind of extends out, right? Yeah. And the fact that not only did she tell her partner, hey, you know, there's this example about real estate, but like her partner immediately went and was like to 10 different agents and was yeah. like, yo, this is something we need to be doing. That's the kind of shit you have to happen with a book. Mm-hmm. I've gotten 4 different messages already. More than four. But 8-figure company owner buying it for his entire leadership staff.
Yeah. Yeah.
9-figure company owner has already bought copies for his co-founder and a few of his other leadership staff. Somebody messaged me and he owns 14 gyms, and one of the heads of one of his gyms, I've known him kind of throughout the years. Mm-hmm. one of the people who runs one of his gyms is reading it and basically said, like, we need to buy this for all of our, like for all of our staff. So he reached out to me to talk about doing that. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that has to happen with a book. And whether it will continue or whether it won't, you know, I don't know. One of the things that Seth Godin has always said is, you know, it's the author's job to sell the first 10,000 copies of the book. It's the book's job to sell the next million.
Right.
And those types of conversations behind the scenes, if those are the ones I'm told about, I'm hoping that there have been many more that I have not been told about.
Haven't been told about. Froze.
And so I don't know, you know, I don't know what's happening. Right. I don't know what's not happening behind the scenes. I never will.
Right.
Really, but books are always going to be so the rankings on Amazon now are starting to slow down a little bit, as to be expected. Mm-hmm. And they will be slow for a little while, right? As people read the book. As people read the book. And it takes time. Books are a slow game.
My camera cut off. Do we have time for one other quick question, please?
Yes.
Is there anything immediately that you know, unequivocally, I will not do this with the next publisher-driven book release, with obvious challenge? I will not do this, whether in the ramp, whether in the marketing. I can't imagine there are many things like that in the context of the writing. But is there anything that two days into this week-long release, you were absolutely blatantly aware, I ain't doing this shit again. Like, I know I'm not going to do. Or anything that you feel like you should concentrate, flip the coin, either way. Anything that you absolutely know will not be done next time, or anything you absolutely know will be, I will definitely prioritize this thing again next time as top of the list priority because it was so beneficial. Anything come to mind like that? I mean, it's only been a week, but...
The VIP boxes with the Casio watches was something that I think is going to provide a really, really great long-term benefit, relationship benefit.
Outstanding.
Particularly to people who I did not know that well but admired and was able to send them a copy.
Yes.
I think immediately they were like, oh, this guy's different. You know, and I see that there's somebody else who's coming out with a book now and a big book, and he'll hit the New York Times bestseller list. He's a big social media celebrity guy, and it's his first book, and I'm sure it's a good book. But you know, you see the boxes that he sent out, and it's just like it doesn't hold a stick to us, right? You think about the impact that the two of them make when they arrive. So yeah, I mean, I'd do that again. The book launch team, I'd have to think about whether I want to do it again or not. I liked a lot of what I did with the book launch team. I think that it was organized really well. I think that it was executed kind of poorly. And that's the plan was there. I think I'm just not the type of guy who should operate communities.
Right.
And that was my mistake. If I were to do it again, I'm bringing somebody in to do the community. I also probably wouldn't host it on Facebook again. For no other reason than people just aren't like active, ongoing, reliably on Facebook that much. So the engagement within the community was not great as time went on. And a lot of that was my fault. One thing that, you know, I have to decide, we made a pivot, right, with podcasts and being interviewed on other podcasts and things like that to make it not that big of a part of our strategy. And that was kind of by necessity. I think podcasts are really impactful for moving books. I just couldn't get on big podcasts. I mean, it's simple as that. We maybe could have really pushed it and like gotten on like some like mediocre to medium-sized ones. But it's astounding to me how hard it was. You know, it's like you're basically just interviewing the same 15 people on repeat. Like then this new guy comes along with this interesting sounding book that's introduced to you by somebody who you admire and somebody who you're friends with. And like people would just ghost me. Like, they, oh, yeah, right. 100%. Yeah, let's take this to a production team. I'll get right back to you. Like, I don't hear from them again. And it's right. like, what? Like, what did I do? Right? Like that happened a lot. A lot. And it's like, I was introduced to you by the editor-in-chief of, like, a major magazine. Or, like, by this person who I know you're very good friends with. Like, what are you just so busy? Is this not a priority for you? Like, what's going on here, right? So, I don't know what was going on there. It just seems, again, like there's just this big kind of circle jerk thing. So I don't know whether I'd put a push to do podcasts or not. I think it's kind of one of those, like, there's an in crowd and an out crowd. Right. If I do focus on podcasts, though, one thing that I 100% need to do is I need to be much more practiced in how I am describing the book, the benefits of the book, telling stories from the book.
Right.
Basically, become a better conversationalist. I've realized over this period that I'm just not that good at. I'm so used to hosting my own podcast.
Right.
And absolutely. The makeup of this podcast is really me taking up most of the space. That's by design, right? Like, we all discuss this, but that does not work on other podcasts where somebody else hosts it. But all of my reps are in that direction. And so I've done 800-900 episodes that way. It's pretty hard to reverse out of that pattern.
Yeah.
Especially if I'm nervous.
Without question.
I got to get better at that.
The old Goodhart's law applies to podcasts now, as well as all social media. When the measure becomes a goal, it ceases to be a good measure. And there was a time where the idea for a podcast was to have a podcast that was so good that you could eventually monetize it. Right. Now the idea for having a podcast is to do whatever you can to monetize it. Right. So you end up in a situation where they're all trafficking in attention, not information. And if some batshit crazy lady who wands her water gets a lot of listeners, even if nobody agrees with what she's saying, they're going to take precedent on the podcast because, it gets to be all about the download. And I understand why downloads are important. We need metrics for business, but now we're just sort of shortcutting to the metrics. There's a monkey who can say six words. Let's have him on the podcast because his story went viral on Entertainment Tonight on a major network. Like, that's kind of how podcasting is. So I get it. Like you said, they're interviewing the same 15 people over and over again. No disrespect to people that have made themselves into influencers or have influence or are making great money from the podcast. Hats off to you. But it's that. It's no longer what it was designed to be, which was a more intimate way of exchanging information via entertainment from sources that were not along the beaten path quite so much. The sort of the NPR days of, podcast mechanics is far, far behind us. And now it's influence and dollar bills, y'all.
The biggest thing that I learned, and I'll leave it at this because I got to pee. I think the biggest thing that I learned is that the lesson that I've just had pounded into me over and over and over again, which is you're on your own, man.
Yeah.
You're on your own. You're eating your own dinner. Nobody's going to do it with you. Nobody's going to do it for you. Nobody's going to show up like a knight in shining armor and publish you and make you famous or sell tons of books. Like, you... all of these platforms that I think that I probably deserve to be on, I will get on once I become a mega best-selling author.
Right.
You don't get on them so that you become a mega best-selling author. Right. You got to do that shit on your own, and that is going to be scratching and clawing and grinding and building own platforms and putting out own information and doing good work and showing up and networking on my own and supporting other people, even if they don't support me back for a very, very long period of time. in addition to doing actually exemplary work, like yes. remarkable work, like work that stands for itself, that gets passed along. That is up to me. That's a lesson that I've had taught to me over and over and over and over and over again. And this process is no different. You know, it's no different. And there's a part of that that is that I'm optimistic about. You know, I'm under control. Right. I'm under control. And so, I mean, you know what I'm doing now? I'm getting back to work, man.
Right.
I'm not dwelling over what happened or what didn't happen. Right. I'm just getting back to work. Nothing else to do.
Well, you've earned the right to pee, John.
Yeah, but
as the January cover of Midlife Mail, I don't want you to hold it any longer. That's right. It's not good for the prostate.
I do. Don't appreciate you. Bye.
Yeah.